Star Walker Studios presents Star Citizens United, a podcast dedicated to making the most of the future hit PC video game, Star Citizen. This episode is brought to you by Carrier Strike Group 3, a casual, mature, family-friendly, lore-based organization in Star Citizen. Greetings, citizen, and welcome to the Star Citizens United podcast. I'm your host, Lex Starwalker. Today, we'll take a tour of the Osiris and Castor star systems. Hello, citizen. Welcome to episode 35 of Star Citizens United. I'm your host, Lex Starwalker. I am very excited to be flying with you today. I've got a great episode in store today. First off, I want to remind you of the little raffle slash giveaway that I am holding for your own brand shiny new Reliant. So if you would like to enter to win a free Reliant, just visit the show notes for this episode at starwalkerstudios.com/StarCitizensUnited. And toward the bottom of the show notes, you will see a raffle copter entry form. And just follow the instructions there, and you can get a few virtual raffle tickets by doing various things. And again, I want to thank Carrier Strike Group 3, who generously donated the Reliant for this raffle. I want to give a huge shout out and thank you to Dr. Roxo for your 5-star review on iTunes. Dr. Roxo says, great lore. Thanks for making this podcast. It has been great for catching up on all the lore. Thank you, Dr. Roxo. I really appreciate your review, and I'm glad that the show is helping you get immersed in the lore of the game. All right, so as promised, I'm going to talk about two star systems today, starting out with the Osiris system. And there is a great image on the galactic guide to the Osiris system of some hornets flying through a very dangerous looking electrical storm with purple lightning. Definitely go check that out, and I will have a link directly to the galactic guide in the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com if you would like to follow along. Osiris is a red-yellow dwarf on the small end of the sequence that is orbited by a pair of planets in a dense asteroid belt. When discovered in the late 2700s, Osiris had little to naturally draw attention to it, with a small planetary system and an asteroid field readily classified as an imminent danger to navigation rather than a potentially profitable mining target, Osiris seemed initially as if it would be defined only by its proximity to well-traveled jump routes and its potential as a refueling point within reach of a major trade lane. A true survey of the system ended up taking a lot longer than anticipated, as the UEE suddenly found itself in the middle of a revolution. While science teams were en route to the Osiris system to start processing, footage of the massacre of Garen 2 leaked to the populace and ignited public outcry and demonstrations. The Messer regime, already stretched thin, now found that every riot they squashed emboldened and inspired others to take their place. By the time the dust settled and the government finally got back to studying this system forgotten in the turmoil, the first survey results of the inner planet yielded fascinating data. Beneath the cloud layer was an extremely active biosphere capable of supporting human life, playing host to an amazing diversity of species unlike those found anywhere else in the known galaxy. The Osiris system became the first system declared to be a developing system under the Fair Chance Act, proclaimed as such with a great deal of fanfare following a science team's discovery of higher primate equivalents on Osiris 1, by then known as Etos. The system became something of a cause for celebration for environmentalists and expansionists alike. Boasting an Earth-like world that would require relatively minor terraforming for human settlement, OSIRIS became the flashpoint for a new debate over the morality of expansion. Though the thought of terraforming inhabited worlds for human settlement was considered immoral in this political climate, critics questioned the legitimacy of first contact and potential uplift should the indigenous species be capable of sentience. While the formal designation and resulting furor may have once attracted enough attention to the system and its inner planet to ward off everyday smugglers, pirates, and worse, the luster has since worn off. With the looming specter of budgetary cutbacks, the military has relaxed its protection of OSIRIS system, meaning that the UEE military expends little effort in patrolling the system beyond the occasional fleet exercise. Ask the average citizen to describe OSIRIS-1's fabled biosphere, and you will likely hear descriptions of impossibly dense rainforests teeming with every form of life imaginable. The reality is nowhere close. Eetos is on the extreme solar side of OSIRIS Greenbelt, and life there has adapted very differently than on Earth. The first thing to understand is that life on Eetos does not thrive in the open. There are no teeming forests reaching for the sky or wild, untamed polar steppes. While the atmosphere can support human life, the proximity to the star means that most evolution has occurred underground, hidden from initial survey scans. Underground, the world is much more interesting. Eetos has an extensive miles-deep cave system that worms its way into the planet's mantle. There, a variety of life forms have taken hold, ranging from spiny rock lobsters to a divergent set of species that might best be described as a prismatic disc. One of the deciding factors behind Eetos' formal protection is Fair's ape, a vaguely human-like primate that biologists believe has the potential to develop higher thinking. With what can only be described as a natural sad face and a seemingly gentle nature, Fair's ape became the iconic image of the Eetosian preservation movement. In recent years, Eetos has become home to increasingly bold smugglers and illegal corporate research surveys. These range from slash-and-burn pirates seeking their own Fair's ape skull mug to megacorporations processing underground biomass by the cubic kilometer, in search of everything from cure-all elixirs to legitimate medicinal items to biological weapons. There is no land set out for these illicit visitors, although landing zones are rarely difficult to locate for those who travel the asteroid belt and roam near the planet. There are a few major openings to the world's cave network, and those seeking to do business here tend to plainly mark the ones they have used. The OSIRIS asteroid belt is one of the densest yet discovered, and is believed by stellar geologists to be a strong representation of a developing planet. Most agree that within several billion years, enough material will have condensed for the OSIRIS belt to serve as the basis for a new world. There's little of interest here to miners or other visitors. Heavy and rare metals are present only in minute quantities, so spread out as to make current mobile mining operations untenable. The gas giant OSIRIS II was what initially drew prospectors to the system. OSIRIS II is a large Jovian world with naturally pure hydrogen. It is the ideal stopover for anyone seeking to refuel jump engines or thrusters. While technically under the protection of the Fair Chance Act, OSIRIS II was quickly excluded via legislation and made available under license to both direct fueling companies and refinery concerns. Because of how the system's jump points fall, OSIRIS II can serve to fuel passing ships without any practical impact to the life forms on Eetos. Although trade prospects in the nearby stellar region have diminished since OSIRIS' initial discovery, one active refueling station remains at an OSIRIS II Lagrange point to this day. Branding on the station changes so frequently as to be unprintable. What was once a Cry Astro flagship station now hops from unknown brand to unknown brand on a monthly basis. So OSIRIS might be an interesting place to visit in game. Have to be careful though, going there and where you go in system, as parts of it are off limits. I'd like to take a minute to tell you about Carrier Strike Group 3, the sponsor for this episode of Star Citizens United. Carrier Strike Group 3 is a family-friendly, mature player group in Star Citizen that you can become a part of. They have all kinds of lore about their unit and about their ships and histories on their website, which I will have linked in the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com. They have a casual play style and have units and squadrons for pretty much every interest in the game. Carrier Strike Group 3 is here to have fun, to make friends, and they're not concerned about ruling the universe or making the game into a job. They also already have an international player base. So if you're looking to make some new friends in the game and you're into the lore of the game like I am, and you want to enjoy Star Citizen as a casual player, check out Carrier Strike Group 3. All right, our next system on our tour of the galaxy today is the Castra system. And I will have a link to the Galactic Guide on this system in the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com. The history of the Castra system might be as close of a mirror to humanity's relationship with the Xi'an as you can find. Discovered in 2544, only 14 years after our first encounter with the Xi'an, Castra was terraformed for military use. As tensions with the Xi'an relaxed, so did the military's presence in the system. Today, Castra is primarily a trading hub, though certain areas have stayed under military control and can be ready for action at a moment's notice. Castra is a simple system containing two planets orbiting a stunning blue-white star. It was discovered by UPE military pathfinders probing the periline for undiscovered jump points. After the initial exploration, early reports noted the system as unremarkable from an astronomical perspective. Yet the military brass immediately grasped its strategic importance as a staging post for the brewing Xi'an conflict. The system was named Castra, after the ancient Roman term for land used by the military as a defensive position, and terraforming of its second planet began immediately. Decades later, when a jump point from Castra into Xi'an territory was discovered, the system was thrust into the front lines of the conflict. As government funding flooded the system to improve its defensive fortifications and military infrastructure, it quickly changed from a mere staging post into a focal point of the Xi'an Cold War. A large orbital platform was even built to support capital ships and long-range bombers, which were ever ready to attack Xi'an space should the order be given. When the Messer regime fell, the UEE tried to ease tensions with the Xi'an. In 2789, in a show of good faith, the UEE reduced their military footprint and, for the first time after two centuries of strict control, permitted the public to move into the Castra system. The decision was, and still is for some, a controversial one. A hawkish minority of military bureaucrats and political elites believe the system best serves the Empire as a dedicated military outpost. Upon Castra's conversion, businesses arrived in droves to take advantage of the system's exceptional infrastructure and affordable real estate. At this point, that makes Castra a prime destination for haulers looking to offload raw materials and leave with goods. Ah, there you go, haulers. Head to Castra. Sounds like a good moneymaker. Recently, Castra's government has pushed to increase tourism to the system in an attempt to diversify their industries. Castra's first planet lacks an atmosphere or any raw materials worth mining. Still, humans realized that Castra 1 was good for one thing, target practice. Designated Bullseye by the UEE Navy, this dead world was used for bombing runs during the Cold War. Today, the way the system star reflects off Castra 1's pockmarked surface is probably the most interesting thing about it. Castra 2 is the only planet in the system suitable for habitation. The UEE military designated the planet as Castra Command, which was shortened to CASCOM, an unofficial name that has stuck, much to the dismay of some current politicians. The military terraformed the planet as fast as possible. Some scientists today even say possibly too fast, suggesting that the escalated speed at which CASTCOM was made ready is to blame for its pronounced cloud layer. The military wanted to construct an ideal defensive position, so they dug in to the top of Mount Ulysses to build the city of Sherman, making it both superbly secure and breathtakingly beautiful. This fortress city, situated above the clouds, has earned the nickname Island in the Sky. Upon seeing Sherman for the first time, Admiral Kamasi Klein famously said, "It's the city of my dreams, picturesque and protected by big guns." Since Sherman was under government control for centuries, it remains a sterling example of state-sponsored architecture. The oldest government buildings in Sherman reflect the austere Hennoism style that was prominent during the city's initial construction. When monumentalism was championed by Imperator Messer III, Sherman's skyline was updated to reflect the style. Today, Sherman's historic architecture remains as one of the primary reasons to visit the city. Ever since the military opened the system to citizens and civilians, Sherman has searched to define its cultural identity. For centuries, living on Castra II was an assignment, not a choice. People from every corner of the empire spent time there, but few put down roots. When the system opened up, industry became the planet's most obvious new resident. Although companies like Kruger Intergalactic injected new life into the planet, they did little to give it a new identity among the masses of other imperial worlds. That changed in 2833 when the planet elected Andrei Novoselov president. President Novoselov worked closely with the business community to attract more residents to Sherman. For years, businesses had struggled to find enough employees to fill available positions. Together, they launched pro-Sherman promotional campaigns on planets around the empire. One of those campaigns resurrected the Island in the Sky motif and featured the iconic image of the mountaintop city sitting above cloud cover, sparkling from the light pollution of cities below. For the first time, the Empire saw Sherman as more than a military outpost or industrial park. Really? So hundreds of years in the future, we still have light pollution? I find that very unlikely. It was President Novoselov's hope that he would see Castra II earn representation in his lifetime, but sadly his transition from president to planetary governor never came to pass, and the planet has yet to earn its senatorial seat. President Novoselov's push to populate the planet worked. As more people arrived, so did a wide variety of service industries to meet the increasing demand. Sherman became a melting pot of high-end stores, restaurants, and hotels, intermixed with businesses geared toward middle-class and blue-collar workers. In many parts of the city, people in designer suits and those in graphene-toed boots shop, dine, and live in the same part of town. Recently, CASTCOM's cheap real estate and scenic views have become a popular home for retirees. So CASTCOM is Space Florida. I'm sure there are lots of interesting news stories coming from CASTCOM then. In an effort to attract a younger crowd, Sherman has promoted its beautiful mountaintop location as the Versus premier extreme sports destination. For a while, paragliding above the clouds was extremely popular until numerous amateur paragliders landed on military installations and forced the city to impose a ban on the practice. Even if paragliding has been prohibited around Mount Ulysses, there is more than enough awe and adventure awaiting anyone who visits Castra II. All right, well, there's what we know about the Castra system. So go check out Space Florida sometime. I hope that you enjoyed our tour of the galaxy today. Again, I want to remind you to head on over to the website, starwalkerstudios.com. In the show notes, you can find the entry form for the raffle for the free Reliant. You can also find other valuable information there as well, including links to the galactic guides I discussed today. You can also find a link to our Patreon page as well as our donate button if you'd like to help support the studio and keep the show coming into your ear holes every week. If you would like to reach me, you can do so by emailing me at scupodcast@gmail.com. You can find me on Google Plus by searching for Lex Starwalker, and you can follow me on Twitter at Lex Starwalker. Also, real quick, I'll let you know some of the other podcast goodness that is coming out this week from Starwalker Studios. Yesterday, I released episode 52 of Game Master's Journey, where I speak with my guest Mark Gerringer about his experiences writing for Paizo. So if you're someone who's interested in dipping your toe into the world of writing for tabletop RPG game companies, definitely check out that episode of Game Master's Journey at StarwalkerStudios.com. Later this week, we are coming out with another episode of Beer Tasters, which is our craft brew homebrew podcast. And every week we try a couple beers on the show, my wife, Nikki, and I, and we tell you what we think of them. And we also talk about the craft beer hobby and homebrewing hobby in general. So check out Beer Tasters as well at StarwalkerStudios.com. And coming up very soon in October, we will be launching our newest podcast in the Starwalker Studios family, the Expanse Unofficial Podcast. So if you don't know about the Expanse, the hot new show coming to the Sci-Fi Channel, based on an awesome series of space opera novels, where have you been? Crawl out from under that rock. Go check out The Expanse. You can find it on Sci-Fi Channel's website, or just Google The Expanse and it's easy to find. And we are going to be doing a podcast all about the show, all about everything to do with the show. And we're going to be starting that in October in anticipation of the premiere of the show in December. So check that out as well at StarwalkerStudios.com. I want to thank you so much for strapping in and flying with me today on another episode of Star Citizens United. Until next time, I'll see you out there. This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts. Please see all that Starwalker Studios has to offer at StarwalkerStudios.com.